is ready to hear argument in 040865 In Re Merrill Lynch Trust Company, FSB.
May it please the court, Mr. Chuck Gall will present argument for relators. Relators will be 5 minutes for rebuttal.
If the court please, in this case, the issue is whether a plaintiff who is admittedly a party to a broad arbitration provision can avoid it by clever pleading and tactical maneuvers concerning who he sues and who he chooses not to sue. Here it's undisputed that the plaintiff signed a cash management agreement when they came to Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith, who all refer to as Pierce. The plaintiffs purchased a life insurance product from their Pierce financial advisor, through their Pierce financial advisor, as a result of financial advice given by that Pierce financial advisor.
My question is, what is the evidence that when Medina was giving financial advice specifically about buying life insurance as part of the portfolio, that he was acting as the agent of Merrill Lynch?
Pierce, Fenner, and Smith? Well, that was the only capacity in which he could act. He had to have a securities license to make the sale. He was paid by Pierce. His employment was with Pierce. He was only employed by one entity, Pierce. All this is in his affidavit in tab 5. He was employed by Pierce. He was paid by Pierce. He wasn't paid
There's
by
There's no the contrary evidence. And I'm focusing on when he was giving them financial services advice, saying include insurance in your portfolio.
There's no contrary evidence. And, in fact, in their pleadings, they admit that the life insurance, the one admission in their pleadings is that the life insurance was part of this financial foundation. It was recommended and grew out of what's called this financial foundation report that was provided by Medina as a financial advisor to the Alanese.
Was this an investment account under a different name? Call it now financial services advice,
yes.
Basically?
Yes, basically.
Series 7 and 63 securities licenses.
Absolutely. Okay. And that's exactly what Mr. Medina was doing. They didn't come to him and say, we'd like to buy some life insurance. Could you help us with a life insurance policy? They came and said, we recovered $2 million or $3 million, whatever the number is, of dollars as a result of another lawsuit. That's what happened here. They came and they said, we've got this bundle of money. How would you have us invest it, Mr. Medina? And with his securities license, he said, here's a variety of products we can provide you. And they opened, they first put the cash in the CMA account, which is governed by this agreement that contains the arbitration clause. Then out of that grows the rest of the investments. In that regard, it's exactly like the Jurisdiction versus Bank One case that Judge Lake decided in our briefs. There, the customer goes into Bank One. He opens up a Bank One bank account. He's introduced, in this case, it's a different person. I mean, in the Bank One case, he's introduced to a Bank One broker. He buys securities through Bank One and complains about the securities. And the court says, hey, the genesis of your relationship was the Bank One bank account. And it has an arbitration clause. All these claims against Bank One Securities have got to go to arbitration. And it's the same facts with one exception. In the Bank One case, they actually sued Bank One as well as Bank One Securities. In this case, what I consider to be a transparent attempt to avoid arbitration, what they've done is they've only sued Maryland's Trust, Maryland's Life Insurance Company, and Henry Medina, and kind of tried to ignore the existence of Pierce and the relationship. And the reason's obvious, that they're trying to avoid arbitration.
What if this was Prudential Life Insurance and a bank trustee, and let's say different entities, unaffiliated entities? The nature of the investment advice would be irrelevant, wouldn't it? I mean, if you were claiming that there was a conflict of interest between selling a life insurance policy and acting as the trustee to hold that policy, and they weren't related to Pierce, loan, then there would be no claim that they'd be bound by the arbitration clause.
Well, I think you could. There wouldn't be an agency.
If you're solely suing for the conflict of interest, you shouldn't have. You had a conflict. You shouldn't have sold this policy.
If you under the agency argument, I don't think so. I think you could, depending upon the facts, you might have an equitable the ability to compel equitable to if the claim was against equitable.
If the claim is strictly conflict of interest, if it's not, this was a bad investment. It was a wrong investment.
I don't think it makes a difference whether it's conflict of interest or a wrong investment as to the result of the case. I don't think that's the controlling. That's the control. I don't think that controls the result. I think in your hypothetical, if the seller of the life insurance was equitable, I think you could still end up in arbitration through equitable estoppel. Equitable could be compelled through equitable estoppel to arbitrate, or could compel arbitration.
Back up a bit. We're at FAA, in deciding whether a non-signatory is bound, do we apply state law or federal law?
Under the Federal Arbitration Act, in determining whether a non-signatory is bound, I think you apply the Federal Arbitration Act.
Why is that? In deciding whether there was a contract normally, first options, U.S. Supreme Court says we look to state law.
But I don't think you're deciding whether a contract exactly exists. You're determining the scope of the Federal Arbitration Act and applying rules under the Federal Arbitration Act. And what the Fifth Circuit Grigson said and all the other circuits have said, under the Federal Arbitration Act, there's a way to get to arbitration for a non-signatory. And one of the ways, agency's one way, equitable estoppel's another. And I don't think Texas Supreme Court or a Texas court can say, well, we're under the Federal Arbitration Act, and we're going to say equitable estoppel doesn't apply in Texas because, you know, Texas law, state law, doesn't recognize that. It's a federal system. It's a federal act, and it's got to be applied consistently. It's no different than paint versus flood and concrete.
But as I read first options, if a state had a rule that there are no oral contracts in this state, and there are no written contracts, do not count unless they're signed. Federal Arbitration Act doesn't require arbitration clause to be signed. As I read first options, a state, as long as it applies to every contract, could say that the only contracts in this state we're going to enforce are signed ones, including arbitration clauses. And that would not trump the FAA, but it would govern.
It seems to me, I don't agree with you. I think it under the Federal Arbitration Act, if the Federal Arbitration Act says these agreements are enforceable under this circumstance, a state can't undo that because it's a federal, it's a matter of federal substantive law that should be applied consistently.
So what are the elements of equitable estoppel under federal law?
Under Grigson, the Grigson court says if you are attempting to enforce the contract, you presume the existence of the contract at that first prong, or if you assert substantially independent concerted misconduct by a signatory and a non-signatory, if either of those apply, then equitable estoppel. But Grigson also says, and you mentioned this during the earlier argument, the linchpin of it is fairness, and that basically it looks at whether it's fair under the circumstances to compel arbitration. I'm not sure. That's
no test at all.
I think that argument. I understand your argument, and I think that is room for criticism of it. But that's what the case says, and I think it does give the court some ability to mold to a particular fact situation. And candidly, you look at the cases, and they do. You know, it isn't a bright line test. As much as they try to say it is, I think in all candor, you look at whether it's fair in the circumstances that this person should be able to avoid this agreement, given the circumstances that they're presenting.
What if Medina had advised her to purchase this life insurance policy and, in fact, sold it to her, but she had written the check from her savings account that wasn't Ed Pierce?
I think here it is not insignificant that the money came from the the cash manager account. But I don't think that's the telling point. I think if you had all the facts that we've got, that she wrote it out of another bank account, you'd still
arbitrate, even though there's no arbitration agreement anywhere except for that.
But when she came to Pierce, or they came, you had a she in your hypothetical. When they came, the Alanises came to Pierce, they were obtaining advice from Henry Medina, and as part of that, they set up an account, and they said, any disputes that we have with you concerning anything, any of the advice we give you, we're going to compel it. They're going to go to arbitration. So they don't say, it's not that the only disputes we're going to compel arbitration relate to money, advice that you pay for out of the cash management account. It's any and all controversies we have relating to any transaction we undertake with you. And that's what happened. There was advice given, there was a policy purchased, and again, I think it's helpful under these facts that the money came from the cash management account. I don't think it's totally right. We focused here on equitable estoppel in a few moments of our talk. I do think the agency argument deserves some mention as well. This case is virtually identical factually to the Pritzker case from the Third Circuit that we've cited. The only difference there is it was a different, it's even Merrill Lynch. It's just a different Merrill Lynch subsidiary. There was Merrill Lynch Asset Management that was involved in the sale of the security. Here it's Merrill Lynch Life Insurance and Merrill Lynch Trust Company. But otherwise, the case is identical. Again, the only difference being they chose to sue Pierce in that case. They didn't choose to sue Pierce.
Well, they couldn't have sued Pierce here for a violation of the trust code or the insurance code.
I think they could have alleged a conspiracy. They could have alleged agency. I mean,
you can always sue.
There's theories. Let me tell you, Pierce gets sued for a lot of different stuff. Yes, they could have. They couldn't have sued solely for breach of trust. I agree with that.
Well, but what I'm saying is if the plaintiff decides, all I want to sue for here is violation of the trust code.
Right.
That's it.
Okay.
Pierce has nothing to do with that.
Well, but Pierce did have something to do with it because the evidence here shows that but for the opening of the account of Pierce, Merrill Lynch Life Insurance Company would not have sold the product in question to the Alanises.
Do they only sell their products to that vehicle?
Yes, and that's what the record shows. And it's in tab 7 or tab 5 of the record.
But if the sole claim is, the only liability you're seeking to impose is under the trust code, and there's no liability under the trust code against Pierce, I don't understand why you would include Pierce in the lawsuit.
Well, include him or not, isn't the telling factor in whether or not you are entitled to compel arbitration. Whether Pierce is a party here doesn't dictate the result. In fact, in Grigson, if you look at page 528 in Grigson, they point out that it's particularly important to apply equitable estoppel where the signator who's bound up in this transaction is not a defendant because they're, in effect, getting drug into litigation when they've contracted that any time they're involved, it's going to go to arbitration. So the Grigson Court would say that's an especially important situation in which to use equitable estoppel is where, again, the party that is the signator is
What obligation did they allege was breached?
They allege that we committed a conflict of interest when Merrill Lynch's trustee of the trust company bought a policy of insurance from Merrill Lynch Life Insurance.
Merrill Lynch Trust violated the conflict of interest.
That's what they.
But Pierce is not involved in that.
Well, but the Pierce broker was the one who recommended it. The Pierce broker was the one who sold the policy. The Pierce broker was the one that was paid for the policy. And the evidence shows that, but for the role of Pierce in the transaction, there wouldn't have been a sale.
But you're not setting up a but for test for equitable estoppel, are you? That anybody who but for the guy who ran the red light on the way to the office today. I mean, it's got to be where the legal obligation arises that you're suing on. And it strikes me that if you're suing for a violation of the trust code and you claim trust violated the trust code, why would you want Pierce in there, and why does it matter that the funds, if you're not suing on the investment advice, but you're suing for violation of the inter-affiliate transaction, what, I don't understand Pierce's role in that.
Well, Pierce's role is that the Pierce broker sold the life insurance.
I understand they're factual.
I see.
I don't understand the legal duty that you're claiming they violated.
I'm not claiming Pierce violated.
Nor are they.
Right, I understand that. But as to your but-for test, I don't think I'm going to answer that part of your question. If you look at Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith versus Eddings, which is a case out of the Waco court, it's almost this exact trust situation involving a trust and a claim by a settlor of a trust. And the court there said, even though it's a claim by a settlor involving breach of the trust against what you have is the relationship wouldn't have existed but for the cash management agreement. It's almost exactly this fact situation, and they can fill, and the claim is made.
Well, let me ask this: let's say that you were suing trust for violating a provision of the securities laws, you didn't. I know this doesn't apply to trust, but you didn't sell it pursuant to a required disclosure in law or something like that, and you were simply suing for the non-disclosure under the securities laws.
And who are you suing?
The
trustee?
Trust, yes. Then what would Pierce have to do with that?
Maybe nothing.
But you'd still
depends
say
on the fact
here that because the money came from Pierce.
It depends. If the Merrill Lynch broker is accused of having made the...
You don't care about who gave you the advice to go to the trust. What you're suing is because the trust didn't disclose something to you.
It depends on who's accused of not making the disclosure. If the trustee is Joe Blow and he didn't make a disclosure, then that's got nothing to do with us. But if the alleged non-disclosure was by Henry Medina, who's got a securities license, and he's accused of not having disclosed something, then Pierce is right in the middle of it. You can't have any more interdependent and concerted alleged misconduct than if there's only one actor in this play, and it's Henry Medina. And that's the point here. There's only one person who's alleged to have done anything wrong, and that's the broker.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party.
May it please the court, Mr. Hector Canales will present argument for the real party of interest.
May it please the court, thank you very much for your time and consideration in this matter. My client's case arises from the factual scenario in which the parties to this lawsuit, what I will call the insurance company and the trust company, and Mr. Medina acting as the agent of the insurance company, have all admitted to statutory violations of the Texas Trust Code and the Texas Insurance Code. And so with that as our claim that we are making on behalf and against those specific parties, I want to address the question that I believe the court has been asking in this case and in the previous two cases that were heard, and that is, why wasn't the brokerage firm, he referred to Pierce, I call it the brokerage firm, why wasn't the brokerage firm sued? And there is a factual and legal answer to that. Clearly, anybody can sue. The question is, can you legitimately sue? I have been accused here of being slick with the court, artful pleading, and using tactical maneuvers. I submit to the court that I have not. What I have been is honest and forthright in who I have chosen to sue and not taking the shotgun approach and sued every entity or affiliate out there that has the words Merrill Lynch in front of it. Because in this particular case, the claims are for violations of the Texas Trust Code by a trustee engaging in self-dealing from buying an insurance policy from its affiliate, Merrill Lynch Life Insurance Company. There is no dispute as to that.
Life insurance products that were purchased, did they have an investment component in them?
Yes, Your Honor, they do. They are variable life insurance policies, and a portion of the premiums that go in are invested in mutual funds in this particular case. But with regards to that, I think that there is a red herring and potential confusion that is being forwarded here by confusing the qualifications that an insurance agent must have in order to sell one of these policies that has a securities component to it.
Could Mr. Medina have sold this insurance product without having his securities licenses, Series 7, Series 63, perhaps?
I have. The answer to that question, Your Honor, honestly is...
Could he have done it legally?
I do not know. I have tried very, very hard to research this matter. The petitioners in this case have cited the Texas Administrative Code, I believe, Title 28.19701, whatever's in the brief. That particular section deals with claims adjusters. I don't find anything in particular that says you have to have these series of licenses. What I have looked at and cited in my brief is I've gone to the Texas Insurance Code, Chapter 21.701, and it says in there that all you have to have is a Group 1 life insurance policy, which Mr. Medina, the record unquestionably says, had in order to sell, and it specifically points out in there, variable annuity contracts or variable life insurance contracts. So my position, Your Honor, is, and I would stand to be corrected by it, but I could not find anything that specifically says that you have to have a Series 763 or whatever. Regardless of that, Judge.
Did Mr. Medina give advice to your clients on purchasing these insurance products?
No, Your Honor, he did not. What has been referenced here is the brokerage firm created a document that was prepared by the brokerage firm that, amongst many other things, included a section on life insurance. Now, Mr. Medina was the go-between of having prepared that particular document and presenting things to my client. But it's important, I think, to understand that Mr. Medina wears several different hats here. There is no doubt he is a licensed insurance agent.
Is he also an agent of Merrill Lynch?
And 19 other companies as well, Your Honor, including AIG. If you look at, and it's in the record, if you look at his appointment schedule, he could be an agent in the selling. And there is a difference between the recommendation of a particular insurance product and selling a product. You have to be, it is the law in this state, that you must be a licensed insurance agent. You've got to have a Group 1, at least a Group 1, in order to sell an insurance policy. And that is the capacity that Mr. Medina is being sued in here. And that's where I get back, hey, look.
Who recommended that they purchase insurance, an insurance policy as part of their portfolio?
And
who recommended that they create irrevocable trust?
According to Mr. Medina, in his affidavit that was attached to part of the record at the trial court level, he says that life insurance company, a fellow by the name of Nick Harrison, recommended it along with my client's attorney at the time. He claims that he was present at that particular meeting, and then he also claims that the trust company recommended along with my client's lawyer, different lawyer, not me at the time, obviously.
Is that lawyer, was he subject to the underlying litigation as well?
No, Your Honor, he has not been named in the litigation, but I will tell you that he is, I guess now the term is, a person of interest in the litigation. But there is no arbitration agreement between my clients and the attorney whatsoever.
Is there any evidence in the record as to whether Mr. Medina was paid commissions or fees for the sale of these products?
Yes, Your Honor, there is evidence in the record of that. Mr. Medina, Merrill Lynch Life Insurance Company paid Mr. Medina a commission for the sale of this particular product. Now, the method in which that was paid was Merrill Lynch, the life insurance company, gave funds to the brokerage firm. The brokerage firm then distributes what are known in its world as production credits. And I would submit to the court that the reason they do that is the brokerage firm cannot pay Mr. Medina in cash for something that the brokerage firm is precluded as a matter of law from engaging in, and that is the sale of insurance.
And why did the insurance company pay them the premium?
Well, because I don't know. Because I'm sure, I guess it's a Merrill Lynch, it was a Merrill Lynch product. And I do not know the rationale behind Merrill Lynch's products, but I do know that he was...
If it's a Merrill Lynch product,
well, it's a life insurance company product, yes.
Okay. And they're affiliated with Merrill Lynch. He's an employee of Merrill Lynch and many other companies. Why is not Merrill Lynch protected under an arbitration agreement?
Because as the Grigson court says in this particular case, we are not relying upon or seeking to gain any damages or any responsibility on behalf of the brokerage firm. In fact, the testimony in this case from the corporate representative of the life insurance company and the corporate representative of the brokerage firm is that they have no responsibilities underneath the brokerage firm agreement, and vice versa. The brokerage firm has no responsibilities under the insurance contract or the trust contract, which I submit to the court, or the document. You did not hear the petitioner say one thing about what are the true contracts at issue in this case.
I'm going to be real clear in your answer to my question a minute
ago. Okay.
What was the evidence on who made recommendations to do an irrevocable trust and to buy insurance? And you said it was Mr. Harrison, and it wasn't clear to me, is there any evidence at all that the brokerage firm was involved in making these recommendations?
No, there is not. In fact, there is evidence in the record replete that it was the brokerage firm had no involvement. That's and I know that's completely 180 degrees different from what Mr. Gall just told the court. But that
is
the
hard to understand. I mean, I suppose we need to go read the record. But how would the life insurance company even know that the account existed if the brokerage firm didn't? Mr. Medina didn't say that it existed.
It's irrelevant to the life insurance company, and their corporate representative said so. They said, it doesn't matter where the money comes from.
But I mean, how did they know? Did they knock on the door?
I mean, was this a door-to-door sale? Or?
No, Mr. Medina called the life insurance company and brought them to my clients.
Well, isn't that... And he was the financial advisor at the brokerage company.
Yes, sir. But when he is engaged in the selling of insurance, he does so. He must do so as a licensed insurance agent. Another point in the record, there is an affidavit submitted by Mr. Ed Felt, who is the who swears that he is the administrator manager employed by the brokerage firm. And in paragraph 4, he makes a statement, and I quote, "These accounts," and he's relating to the brokerage firm accounts, "these accounts bear no relationship to the Juan Manuel or Norma Leticia Irrevocable Life Insurance Trust." So you have the brokerage firm themselves saying there's no relationship whatsoever between the accounts that are governed by this agreement that they're relying on and the trust.
But I'm getting it. Financial services were provided. Financial planning. Forget about the account. There was some sort of agreement, oral or otherwise, under which financial services were provided. And who, what is the evidence on what entity was providing financial services and was advising your clients, get into an irrevocable trust, and one of the things you want to buy is a policy from somebody?
Well, the financial services are, mind you, the product at issue here, this irrevocable trust, has one asset in it, and it is this life insurance policy. Then there are these other brokerage firm accounts, okay, that or lots of services were rendered into those accounts. And these are the two accounts that...
Is it undisputed, I assume, that a piece of the financial services provided was to get into this irrevocable trust? Among all these other investments, we want you to invest here, 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 and here.
I don't think that's part of their financial services. And the reason why is the brokerage firm cannot engage in those kinds. I mean, it's one thing to say, hey, you have options available to you, that there are trusts out there and there are brokerage firms. And
right, I go to an investment advisor. I said, give me some investment advice. He might not be able to sell me the life insurance, but he can tell me one thing your portfolio ought to include is an irrevocable trust that holds an insurance policy like this. Now, who provided that advice?
Mr. Medina.
And what hat did he have on when he provided that advice?
I think when he provided that hat, he had the hat of financial advisor on. But that's not what was being complained about.
And so he worked for the brokerage company as financial advisor.
Yes, there's no dispute about that. He's a financial advisor for Merrill Lynch, for the brokerage.
So you're not complaining that the advice to get a life insurance policy was bad advice.
No.
So what's your damages?
My damages come under the Texas Trust Code and the Texas.
Know what they come under. What are your damages? I can see the list of 12 different things you've alleged. Mm-hmm. As I read your petition, your complaint is that I suppose it would be to disgorge the profits because of self-dealing.
Well, that would be one. I think you also have under the Trust Code violations, you would have the any fees that were paid. Because there's an admitted breach of fiduciary duty by the trustee, I think I would be entitled to recoup any fees that were paid to the trustee.
But you wouldn't be entitled to recoup premiums for a policy that where your client actually got life insurance coverage, just the fees.
Yes, sir. I think that's correct. Also, I believe under 2121. If I could show that in the sale of the insurance policy that it was that material misrepresentations were made, that I would have damages that could result from those
which would be what other than disgorging the fees?
I think in that particular it would be the disgorgement of fees, and I think the amounts paid into the premiums because in this case, and now I kind of get into the facts of the premiums a little bit. There was an initial premium of $35,000, and then there were subsequent payments of $35,000 each year that were letters were sent from the insurance company to my client saying these are due, and truly they were optional, but there was a misrepresentation I claim that says that made it appear as if they were not optional, as they were required. So we have these seven additional payments that were made that I think cause misrepresentations under 2121 made by the insurance company. And those were not representations made by Mr. Medina. Those are representations that were made from letters coming from the insurance company. I do because Mr. Gall said that this case is exactly like the juror.
Let me just add just a couple more questions on that. Your complaint is that it would have been okay if he said life insurance is an option and here are the five companies that do it. But the problem was that he said get it from my affiliate company here. Aren't you really complaining about where he directed them?
No, sir. What I'm complaining about is what Justice had talked about earlier is that it's not that they made a recommendation for life insurance or even to put in an irrevocable life insurance trust. What we're complaining about is what they've admitted to violating, and that is the self-dealing that occurred between the insurance company and the brokerage firm.
But that's like in a negligent entrustment case saying, I'm not complaining about the negligence, I'm complaining about the entrustment. Or I'm not only complaining about the entrustment, not the negligence, but the fact of the matter is negligent entrustment is both.
Well,
you can't have one without the other.
Well, I think that what the petitioners are really saying here is that I must sue, that somehow or another I'm relying upon this relationship that Mr. Medina has to the brokerage firm. And the fact of the matter is that brokerage agreement has nothing to do at all with the violations that we are complaining of. In fact, there is no evidence. They have not cited to the court or given any example of which particular term in the agreement I'm relying upon.
Well, the clause is broader than that. It says any agreement we've had before the CMA agreement or after it. So let's set aside the CMA account wholly aside for the moment. Is there any agreement at all before or after the CMA account to provide financial services?
No. I mean, and I think what controls here is the insurance contract. There's no arbitration agreement in there. The trust agreement actually contemplates court action. There's no arbitration agreement.
I thought you said there were financial services other than the CMA provided.
Oh, sure. There were transactions.
And that's an agreement with the brokerage.
Yes.
And I don't have, and I submit to the court that if I were complaining about transactions that were in these CMA accounts that their manager says bear no relationship to the trust, that would be covered by the arbitration.
Who made the decision to buy an affiliated policy?
That would be the trust.
Who? What individual?
Well, whoever the trustee, whoever the individual trustee was of the trust in this case, the trust purchased the life insurance policy.
You don't know what individual made that decision.
Well, whoever the trustee in name was, I don't know that. I do not recall.
Did Mr. Medina have any involvement?
No, Mr. Medina is not the trustee. Merrill Lynch Trust Company is the trustee, and whoever was overseeing, you know, that particular, whoever's named as the trust, whatever John Doe is named or Jane Doe is named as the trustee.
I thought you said that Mr. Medina was the salesman of the insurance policy, so he did have some involvement in deciding to buy an affiliated policy.
Well, sure, he was present at the meeting, but according to his affidavit, Mr. Nick Harrison from the life insurance company is the person that was recommending and selling the trust. He was present there, but in order for him to be involved in the selling,
well, he picked an affiliated company as opposed to AIG.
Yes, and he could have picked AIG. He is licensed. He's appointed by AIG. Could have been AIG.
Is Mr. Medina an agent of this insurance company?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. He absolutely is.
And I like. Did he have binding authority on an insurance company?
Did he have
binding authority? Yeah, brokers can bind insurance companies.
Sure, absolutely. Because you've gotten to the heart of the issue here is in what agency, what scope of agency was Mr. Medina acting in this case as it relates to the claims that are being made here? Our position is that he could only be acting under the agency of the insurance company because he's selling insurance. And I have the record supports that in two places. If you look at the brokerage firm's manual, policy manual, it says, and I'm quoting, you being the broker, you may sell annuities and other insurance products only in your capacity as a licensed Merrill Lynch Life Agency agent and make your sales only through Merrill Lynch Life Agency. This is the brokerage firm's terms. These are not my words. They have to be working and selling through the life insurance company. The life insurance company corporate rep says he's our agent. There is absolutely no connection. Now, what's key about this Jurevicius case, I don't know if I pronounced that right, in that particular case, the claims made by the plaintiff were that specifically that there was an unauthorized transaction from the bank account to the insurance account. In other words, that unauthorizedly moved money from bank to here. We are not saying that there was any unauthorized deal. In fact, in the record, I think you have our authorizations moving from. So we're not complaining about any particular service or act that brings into question the brokerage agreement.
Now, Mr. Medina was an employee of Merrill Lynch, the brokerage firm.
Yes, Your Honor.
What was his legal relationship with Merrill Lynch Life Insurance and Merrill Lynch Trust?
With the life insurance, he's their agent, Your Honor. He is appointed in the state of Texas to sell their insurance policies. As to trust, I don't believe he has any relationship with them. He doesn't work for them and doesn't have any licenses.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Kelly.
If the court please, as it relates to the question about the capacities in which Mr. Medina was working and what the record shows in that regard, I would point the court to tab 5 in the affidavit of Mr. Medina, as well as the deposition testimony of the Alanese, the plaintiff. It is clear that what was sold here was a bundle of services. He made recommendations, and one of the recommendations was that they purchased this Merrill Lynch life insurance policy, which was an investment deal itself. It was a variable. It was a variable policy that we bought securities within the policy. So there's no doubt that this was part of the overall investment.
What if he had purchased an AIG policy?
I don't think it would make any difference as to it would make a difference as to whether there was a claim for.
Do you think AIG would be able to compel arbitration?
Under these facts, if everything was the same, I think not under agency, but under equitable stop.
If the insurance policy had no investment aspect to it, it was simply term life, would your position change?
No, not really. But I think it helps us. I think it's better for my position that there are securities in there because it makes it clearer that it's all part of the investment advice that was rendered. But I don't think it's crucial. I mean, I don't think it's a dispositive fact.
Do you know if Mr. Medina had to have a securities license to sell these
yes.
insurance products?
We cited the code provision in our brief. I don't have it in my mind, but there is a code provision that so provides.
Y'all take different positions on that, I guess, not surprisingly.
It's just a matter of Texas law, in our view. But I'd also point out he did have both, and he was acting clearly in this situation with both hats on. It's not like he stepped out and said, well, right now I'm just acting as an insurance agent. He was giving financial advice, a bundle of services, and I would point out the record is absolutely clear.
Let me ask you this: if Mr. Medina was only involved in receiving commissions from recommending insurance products with no investment components, would he have had to have a securities license or only a Group One?
If he didn't have the securities aspect to it, he could have sold it like you sell any other policy with a Group One. I'm not an insurance expert, and I may stand to be corrected on that, but that's my understanding, that if it didn't have the investment aspect to it, he's just an insurance agent. He's selling you life insurance like you get in every shopping center around the state. That's my understanding. Again, I would say that I'm not an expert on the insurance laws, but that's my understanding. I would point out there was a question about what the record shows about who was paid by whom, and it is clear that he was paid by Pierce, not paid by the life insurance company. And I also point out, I want to backtrack to the question you asked, Justice O'Neill, about what is are they really kind of picking and choosing who they're suing here? You know, they sued Henry Medina. Henry Medina is not the trustee of the trust.
But he did sell the life insurance policy.
He did sell the policy, but he's not the trustee of the trust. And he was not the trustee. So he can't be he didn't violate any code provision in the state of Texas. He can't be guilty of a conflict of interest because he's not the trustee. So
well, he knew that an affiliated company was buying an affiliated policy.
He did know that.
He's charged with knowledge of the law. So
I agree with that. But he's not the trustee, so he can't be guilty for violating a breach of trust or a conflict of interest or a code provision that's applicable to a trustee, not to him. And I would also point out that they've sued for a lot of things other than just simple breach of trust. If you look at their petition in the case, they've sued for violation of the DTPA, 1746 of the Business Code, breach of fiduciary duty, fraudulent conversion, negligent misrepresentation, negligence, unjust enrichment, theft. So it's not as though that they only sued us for breach of this condition. They look right.
Thank you, counsel. Are
Thank
there
you.
Any further questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
The relationship that the Alanis has had with the company, Merrill Lynch, did that stem from the cash management account? I guess what I'm saying is could they have entered into this financial arrangement without opening a cash management account?
No, the record shows not. The record shows that the way you generate your relationship with Pierce is you come in, you
sign that agreement, which includes the provisions.
No, but that's not, I mean, there's a dispute about that in the record.
Well, I think they disputed.
I mean, there's deposition testimony that you didn't have to have a CMA account with the purchase of life insurance.
You had to have, but they would only sell it to you if you were a Pierce client. The only way they sold it was to Pierce clients.
But you didn't have to have a CMA account to be a Pierce client.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have, the deposition testimony says they only sell to Pierce clients. And I believe the record shows that the only way you have a Pierce client is if you sign a CMA. But whatever might happen hypothetically under some other circumstance, in this case, they had a CMA account that contained the arbitration provision, and the record is clear on the point. They wouldn't sell it to you unless you were a Pierce client.
You already stated that your client didn't pay Mr. Medina directly, but he was indirectly paid.
He was paid by Pierce.
But Pierce got the money from the insurance company, correct?
I don't think the record reflects that, but I wouldn't
dispute. It's in this brief.
I wouldn't dispute that the life insurance company paid some compensation to Pierce. Pierce then, in turn, paid what are called production credits to Mr. Medina, which then, at the end of the year, translates to cash for him.
Wasn't that significant here to determine who Medina was working for?
It seems to me the fact that he was paid by Pierce shows who he was working for. I don't think that's insignificant.
But Pierce wouldn't have paid him unless the policy was sold, correct?
Right. But they wouldn't have paid him for selling a security unless the security was sold. I mean, that's just the product that happened to generate the commission. I mean, that was what he did to generate the commission.
And your position would be no different if the petition said this claim is limited to a violation of the trust code and the insurance code.
I don't think that's the determining factor, because again, you have a situation where the relationship arises the way it arose on this record was through this cash management agreement, through this bundle of advice and services.
If you're not suing on that investment advice, even if you don't have any beef about him putting you into the investment, it's just the self-dealing.
The misconduct is alleged to have occurred through Henry Medina, who is both a broker and a life insurance agent.
If Medina were not sued, if he were non-suited, what then?
Well, it's still his conduct that's an issue. I don't think you ought to be able to maneuver it by deciding who you're going to sue and who you're going to not.
Well, no, I agree with that. But it seems like if you're filing a limited claim for violation of the trust code for self-dealing, you don't care about the advice given, or you have a narrow, simple claim that you can't self-deal like this.
That's not the claim.
I asked the question.
If it were the claim, I still think we'd be entitled to compel arbitration, because the alleged misconduct, the advice that was given that relates to a conflict. But the advice that was given was you should buy this policy.
I thought you said the trustee made that determination. Medina had nothing to do with it.
No, he's on the policy. He's shown on the policy application as the financial advisor. I mean, the Alanis filled out an application. Medina's involved in the application. He's shown on the policy.
But by law, he has to be the insurance agent to do that, not the broker.
Ultimately, these people made the determination to establish this trust as part of this purchase. So it all happens at one time. It's not like there was a trustee sitting here over a trust that decides they're going to buy this policy. There's one integrated transaction that occurs here, and that is set up the trust, buy the policy, all in one fell swoop. So they made one basic decision, which is to buy this policy and appoint Merrill Lynch Trust Company as trustee of this life insurance trust. It's one integrated transaction. There could be situations where you have a trust with a trustee, and the trustee just independently decides he's going to buy life insurance for some beneficiary. That's not what we have here. It's all part of one single integrated transaction. So the real decision to purchase the policy is made by the Alaneses, and to establish this trust is made by the Alaneses as part of this, again, overall financial advice that was given to them by Pierce. Here's what you should do with part of your money.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes all oral arguments for today. The marshal will adjourn the court.